This invasion of the life-giving power of the gospel reveals the true nature of our predicament. There's a memorable scene in the 1999 science fiction movie, The Matrix, which comes to mind at this point. It's a scene where the protagonist, Neo, meets Morpheus for the first time and comes to learn about the reality, or perhaps better, the pseudo-reality of The Matrix. I want to show that scene now. Now, I'm certainly not saying that the Matrix trilogy as a whole is a good guide to Pauline theology, but this scene is suggestive. Because for Paul, the problem is not simply that we as individual human beings have made some bad choices and now find ourselves in need of forgiveness. I mean, that's true, but that's not the whole story. For Paul, the fundamental problem is that human beings, and in fact the entire cosmos, are enslaved under anti-God powers. This comes across in Galatians, where Paul uses the phrase "to be under the power of" 10 times as a way of describing humanity's plight. That is why what is needed to set things right is much more than an act of merciful forgiveness, but rather what is required is a full-scale divine invasion, liberating campaign, or in other words, a new creation. The invasion of the life-giving new creational power of the gospel renders visible to the extent to which all human beings are in the grasp of powers larger than themselves. Our passage from Galatians describes human beings as being enslaved in verse 4 under tastoikeia to kosmu, which is translated in the NRSV as the elemental spirits of the world. And then in verse 5, Paul speaks of those in bondage under the law. Furthermore, in the verse which immediately follows our passage, Paul describes the plight of the Galatians in the following terms. Formerly, when you did not know God, you were enslaved to beings that by nature are not gods. Now, scholars debate the exact meaning of the word stoicheia. Some draw upon the writings of the ancient Greco-Roman world to suggest that Paul is referring to the fundamental building blocks of the universe: earth, wind, fire, air. Others suggest Paul is referring to fundamental principles of learning and philosophy. Others suggest that the stoicheia refer to the opposing binary pairs which constitute the social reality of the world: Jew and Gentile, male and female, slave and free. I'll leave it to my New Testament colleagues to sort out the exact meaning of what Paul is getting at here with the stoicheia. But the presence of the stoicheia at this point, alongside of the law and that which by nature are not gods, is suggestive of a recurring pattern of speaking in Paul's letters, which scholars often refer to as the principalities and powers. We can recognize when Paul is utilizing this mode of discourse when we hear him using terms which are translated in our English Bibles as powers, dominion, authorities, rule and rulers, thrones, spiritual forces, and cosmic powers. A Dutch theologian by the name of Hendrik Berkhof published a book in the years that followed the conclusion of the Second World War. And his book marked the rediscovery of the Pauline doctrine of the principalities and the powers. In the years leading up to the war, scholars and pastors had largely been content to interpret the principalities and powers in one of two ways. There were those who interpreted Paul's talk of the principalities and powers in terms of personal demonic spirits afflicting and possessing individuals, as we might find today in a Frank Peretti novel. Others, of a more liberal persuasion, tended to see Paul's references to the principalities and powers as the holdover from a pre-modern mythological worldview that stood, at the very least, in need of demythologization, if not outright dismissal. Against the liberals, Berkhof insisted that the powers vocabulary was an indispensable component of Paul's letters. Contrary to the conservative or charismatic interpretation, he insisted that Paul's language at this point did not refer to angels and demons hovering in the ether, but rather described structures of the created reality. In support of this argument, Berkhof pointed to Colossians 1:15-17, which reads, "Christ is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For in him all things in heaven and on earth were created, things visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or powers. All things have been created through him and for him." Reflecting upon this passage in a way that resonates with Paul's reference to the elemental spirits of the world in our Galatians 4 passage, Birkhoff understands the powers to be the invisible weight-bearing substratum of the world that have been created in Christ to serve as the linkage between God's love and visible human experience. In a similar vein, the great English missiologist Leslie Newbegin also affirms both the createdness and the necessity of the powers. It is the ordering and structuring of the world through laws, customs, traditions, roles, and institutions that makes human life possible. Newbegin writes, "There has to be some kind of ordered structure of power. Without it, human life would dissolve into anarchy. These structural elements are necessary to guide and protect human life. They serve God's purpose." As a result, Newbegin affirms, the principalities and powers are real. They are invisible, and we cannot locate them in space, but they do not exist as embodied, disembodied entities floating about this world or lurking within it. Rather, they meet us embodied in visible and tangible realities, people, nations, institutions, and they are powerful. The powers do not exist apart from the human agencies in which they are embodied, but at the same time, they transcend this human agency. Think, for example, of a large corporation. It has many executives and employees. Yet it also retains a type of institutional culture that endures across time, even as the major players come and go. Or we might talk of how different academic institutions are often characterized by their own distinctive school spirit, which transcends the choices and actions of its individual students and officers. Or we might even think of mob violence, when men and women who are normally law-abiding citizens get swept up in the barbaric and lawless behavior of the mob. Newbegin admits that the language of the powers is mythological, because we can't spatially locate the authority and influence exercised by the powers. But it's the only language we've got to describe a very real spiritual reality. So let's summarize the ground we've covered so far with respect to the powers. The powers are real. The powers are part of God's good creation. The powers have been created for the sake of preserving life and enabling the conditions necessary for human life and flourishing. However, if we were to stop there, we would not be telling the whole story. We must go on to say that the powers, like all of creation, are fallen. Although they continue to fulfill one half of their function by preserving human life and society against chaos, they now hold the world together only in the act of holding it away from God. Birkhoff explains, "The powers are no longer instruments, linkages between God's love as revealed in Christ and the visible world of creation. In fact, they have become gods." He refers to Galatians 4:8 at this point. "Behaving as though they were the ultimate ground of being and demanding from men an appropriate worship. This is the demonic reversal which has taken place on the invisible side of creation. No longer do the powers bind man and God together. They separate them. They stand as a roadblock between the Creator and his creation." The great Swiss theologian Karl Barth sought to elaborate upon Birkhoff's work in his unfinished volume of his Church Dogmatics on the theme of the Christian life. Barth described human beings as finding themselves at the mercy of the lordless powers, invisible forces which constrain, imprison, direct, and punt humanity back and forth like a football. Examples of the lordless powers given by Barth include Leviathan, which is the state, Mammon, which is money, ideologies and other forces, which include such things as fashion, sport, and humanity's quest for pleasure and efficiency in travel. The origins of the lordless powers, Barthes suggests, may be traced back to man's rebellion against God. Barthes suggests that the attempt to live a lordless life unleashes the rebellion of human abilities against man himself, as the human capacities take on a life of their own, as vividly illustrated in Goethe's poem, The Sorcerer's Apprentice. The French lawyer and intellectual Jacques Ellul recognized a similar reality at play with respect to humanity's relationship to technology. While technology is meant to serve humanity, Ellul observed that humanity has now become the servant of technology, and the sole criterion of all things, including human beings, has become their usefulness. In the spirit of Ellul, James Davison Hunter has recently observed, once technologies, whether military, economic, managerial, or therapeutic, are established, they have a life and logic of their own that will act back on those who consent to use them. I was reminded of this reality while standing on the subway one day earlier this fall. I was standing on one edge of the station platform, and as I looked down to the other end, I was confronted by a scene similar to the one that's appearing on the screen. Hundreds of people were gathered together in one spot, but almost all of them were looking down into their tiny screens, isolated in their own little virtual worlds, and oblivious to the presence of those around them. Were these people simply using their devices? Or was the technology using them?